having, out of friendship for the family upon whose estate, praised be heaven, I and mine have lived rent-free time out of mind, voluntarily undertaken to publish the memoirs of the Rackrent family, I think it my duty to say a few words in the first place concerning myself.
These are the opening lines of Castle Rackrent by Maria Edgeworth.
My real name is Tady Quirk, though in the family I have always been known by no other than Honest Tady.
The novel explores the relationship between the landed gentry and Irish peasants with wit, insight and humour.
I wear a long greatcoat winter and summer, which is very handy, as I never put my arms into the sleeves. They're as good as new, though come Hollantide next I've had it these 7 years. It holds on by a single button round my neck, cloak fashion.
Maria Edgeworth was the most successful author of her generation, but she's been largely forgotten. Her reputation has been unfairly eclipsed by her contemporary, Jane Austen, but the scope of her novels is phenomenal.
Her novels have a much wider social canvas than Jane Austen's novels.
If she's remembered at all, it's for one or two comic novels, but there was so much more to her. Her ideas on education were groundbreaking, and so too were her ideas about the rights of women and on issues like slavery.
I think Maria Edgeworth has been misunderstood as a much more conservative writer than she actually is.
She was Ireland's most prolific and influential writer between Swift and Yeats.
We should call her our most first and most important Irish woman writer.
I'm Susan Manley, and I'm writing a new biography of Maria Edgeworth. I passionately believe she should be better known, and her books should be much more widely read. In this programme, I'm telling the story of her life and her writing. I'm starting in County Longford, in the town the Edgeworth family gave their name to.
I'm here in Edgeworth town, and I'm just walking up now to the rectory to meet Matt Farrell of the Edgeworth Society.
Today, this rectory is where the Edgeworth Society has its headquarters.
Hello, Susan. You're very welcome.
Hi.
Come in.
The Edgeworth's connections with the town go right back to 1585, and in 1619, King James I of England granted Francis Edgeworth 600 acres of land. Francis was the ancestor of Richard Lovell Edgeworth, a talented engineer and inventor. He had 22 children, and the most famous of them, and the one I'm interested in, is the novelist, Maria Edgeworth.
Yes, Susan, we're now heading down the driveway here from the rectory, and we're heading over to Edgeworth's townhouse, which is now called the Manor, and it's a nursing home.
Matt is taking me now to a place that I've been keen to visit for years, the house where Maria lived.
So we're just turning off the main street of Edgeworth Town now, through the gates of Edgeworth Town House, and on the gatepost there's the plaque saying that Maria Edgeworth lived here. And the house is just coming into view now.
We're parked just here now.
Maria came to live at Edgeworth Town House when she was 14, and she was based here for the rest of her life.
So we're in a big square entrance hallway with a cornice around the ceiling. Over to my right, there's a cage with some green and yellow birds in it. And above the doorways to my right, there are two doorways to my right. One of them has a portrait of Maria Edgeworth wearing a bonnet, looking very pretty. It must be her as a very young woman. And I think over the other doorway is a picture of the Abbey Edgeworth. How would this have looked originally, Matt, this hallway?
The hallway actually hasn't changed too much. We have a number of images of the house from its original time. There's been additions to it, but the main part of the body of the house has remained structurally the same.
off this hallway somewhere would have been the library, which was really the central room of the house, the place where really everything happens, where Richard Lovell Edgeworth did lots of his inventing an early telegraph. But it was really an ideas hub, all the family involved in different creative and inventive projects, and, of course, a centre for visitors from all over the world. So ideas were flowing in and out of the house constantly. So is it normally open to the public, Matt?
No, you're privileged now today to be here in the hallway. They very, very kindly allow us to bring visitors here to the house. And more importantly, they allow us access to the walled gardens, which we'll now visit, if that's OK with you.
Mariah Edgeworth was born on New Year's Day in 1768 in a village near Oxford in England. Her mother died when she was just 5. Mariah was deeply upset by this early loss. Her new stepmother couldn't handle the unruly behaviour she displayed as a result, so she was sent away to school in England and stayed there till she was 14. The first surviving letter we have is one she wrote to her stepmother, Honora, when she was 8.
Dear Mama, it is with the greatest pleasure I write to you, as I flatter myself it will make you happy to hear from me. I hope you and my dear Papa are well. School now seems agreeable to me. I have begun French and dancing. I intend to make great improvement in everything I learn.
Her ambition is already obvious, and her father, Richard, recognised that Mariah had talent. He sent her writing challenges while she was still a schoolgirl. For example, asking her to write a story about generosity or to devise a new Arabian Nights tale. Mariah was his second oldest child from the first of his 4 marriages. In many ways, she had a boy's education from the moment she rejoined the family in Ireland at the age of 14. She studied history and political economy and began to help her father manage the Edgeworthstown estate. She was also effectively an extra parent to many of her younger brothers and sisters. And she took a lively interest in how children thought and reasoned.
A lot of the ideas and conversations that find their way into her stories are things that perhaps she's observed or witnessed in the Edgeworth home.
This is Professor Aileen Douglas, head of the School of English at Trinity College Dublin. She's especially interested in Mariah's stories for children.
One of the things that's really interesting is that she develops named characters. So we sort of grow with the children, as it were, from quite young, from 3 or 4 through to adolescence. And the idea is that the age of the characters matches the age of the reader. So children are reading about other children of the same age and with similar capacities and learning as they're learning. And also, because she wrote about the same characters over time, they develop and children really can identify with them.
This may seem obvious to generations who have grown up with the Harry Potter novels, but at the time, it was really new.
One of the other things that's really interesting about Edgeworth's stories is that her child characters talk a lot. They're in conversation with their parents or with other children. So it's really the first time in English literature that we hear a child's voice in quite that way.
Rosamond begged that her mother would be so good as to give her some seeds, which she might sow in her garden. "What sort of seeds do you want, Rosamond?" said her mother. "Any sort, Mama, all sorts, if you please." "Have you room to sow all sorts of seeds, Rosamond, in your little garden? For instance, turnips and carrots and cabbages and cauliflowers and peas and beans and..." "Oh, no, Mama, all those would take up a great deal too much room. I will have only flower seeds." "All sorts of flower seeds?" "No, no, Mama. You know I have not room for all, but I should like to have those which will come up the quickest and which will be the prettiest."
One of the most interesting things is a thing that maybe isn't so visible to us now if we look back on them, because we're so used to it. So she sets the stories in a very everyday world. So we see the children going about their days and, you know, visiting the dairy, or they're walking in the garden, they're growing plants, or they're going to the shops. And these are things that we see all the time in children's literature now. But it was quite unusual, really, to track very mundane activities in quite that way.
So where are we going now, Matt?
So we're heading over to the walled gardens here. So these are the original walled gardens that were attached to Edgeworthstown House, and it's a place where Mariah Edgeworth and members of her family would have enjoyed many pleasurable moments. On our right here, we have a vegetable garden. Up further, we have some fruit, blackberries, apples, apple trees, gooseberries, strawberries, and over in the far corner there, we have some herbs. The garden is laid out in plots. Again, that brings us back to the Edgeworth family. I recall reading where Richard Lovell insisted that all of the children had a plot of their own and experimented with growing. Is that true, Susan, yeah?
I think that's true. And it crops up a lot in her children's stories as well, actually. There are lots of children who are busy little gardeners in a lot of the stories.
The stories Mariah wrote for child readers often show children reading or hearing about theories or ideas and finding ways to test these for themselves.
Some of her stories, like the Harry and Lucy stories, they actually carry out experiments at the tea table. So the mother sort of explains how steam works to the little children. The children delight in doing experiments and in making things. They're always active, observing and using the knowledge that they've gained.
A cold plate was held over the tea urn in which water was boiling, and from which there issued a large quantity of steam or vapour of water. After the plate had been held over the steam a little longer, the water drops on it became larger. They attracted one another. That is to say, one little drop was joined to another till at length the drops ran so much together as to run over the plate. Harry and Lucy were much entertained with this experiment.
Mariah herself shared this delight in experiments. Unusually for a girl in this period, she'd been encouraged to study science as well as literature. And this mixture of subjects, an emphasis on active inquiry as a means for children to be in charge of their own learning, is central to Mariah's book, Practical Education. Here's Sarah Maurer from the University of Notre Dame in Indiana.
When she writes about education from the point of view of trying to give advice, she's always reminding the educator, who she assumes to be the parent, that you got to really be careful that the kid actually knows what's true. So one of the first things, one of the first principles of her practical education is to only tell the child the facts they can understand.
Today, with our focus on child-centered learning, Mariah's approach is strikingly modern.
The emphasis on dialogue with the tutor, the emphasis on an improvisational attention to what the kid is interested in, rather than what they need to learn, and again, a strong emphasis on sensory experience as necessary to the educational process.
Mariah's preface to Practical Education sets out these groundbreaking educational principles.
We have chosen the title of Practical Education to point out that we rely entirely upon practice and experience. To make any progress in the art of education, it must be patiently reduced to an experimental science. We have found from experience that an early knowledge of the first principles of science may be given in conversation, and may be insensibly acquired from the usual incidents of life.
Practical education is full of great anecdotes about things Mariah's younger brothers and sisters said or did. These are genuine conversations, often funny, but Mariah also saw that they gave important clues about how people learn to reason when they're very young.
A little girl, Honora, who was not quite 4 years old, asked her mother to give her a plaything. One of her sisters had just before asked for the same thing. "I cannot give it to you both," said the mother. "No, but I wish you to give it to me and not to Elizabeth." "Don't you wish your sister to have what she wants?" "Mother, if I say that I don't wish so, will you give it to me?"
Ideas about gender and the different education of girls and boys and the differing roles of men and women inevitably come into Maria Edgeworth's writings.
It's interesting that in her stories you often have children paired. So you've got Harry and Lucy, a girl and a boy. And in others of her stories, her Frank stories, you've got Frank and Mary. So you get both perspectives. And also one of the things that is notable is that while the children are very young, there's relatively little difference, and both children do the same things and they're both active in the same kinds of ways. But then in the stories for adolescents, you begin to see gender differences. So, for example, the boy child will go off to boarding school, whereas the girl child will stay at home.
One well-known point of distress for most of Maria Edgeworth's readers is that practical education ends by saying girls should be more restrained than boys. They'll have a different life, so they should be taught about a slightly different life.
But we have to be careful about judging Maria's ideas on gender by the standards of today. To understand just how radical her ideas were, we need to look at the context of the time. Unusually, she insisted on co-education and allowing boys and girls to study science and engineering. And she was adamant that girls were as rational as boys. She herself was an ambitious girl who had to negotiate the limits placed on what women could do and be as she grew up. Here's what her father wrote to her in a letter when she was 10.
"With a benevolent heart, complying temper, and obliging manners, I have no doubt that by your mother's assistance you might become a very excellent and highly improved woman. Your person, my dear Maria, will be exactly in the middle point between beauty and plainness. Handsome enough, if accompanied with gentleness, reserve, and real good sense, but plain enough to be contemptible, if unattended with good qualities of the head and heart. These you have it in your power to attain, and your behaviour this summer gives me hopes that your ambition is excited towards the true perfection of a female character."
Maria must have felt under a lot of pressure to achieve the perfection her father outlines here. He was in some ways quite an advanced thinker about women's rights. But he'd been strongly influenced as a very young man by his best friend, Thomas Day. Day was later a pioneering propagandist against slavery. His convictions about women were less forward-thinking.
Her father had been corresponding with his good friend Thomas Day, who was also very interested in educational theory. And they both agreed that they weren't super positive about women writers. She wanted to argue with them. And so when she sort of objected to her father and Thomas Day's conversation about why women shouldn't write, her father suggested that she write the objections down. And basically those became a set of letters championing literary ladies.
Edgeworth published really her first publication for adults in 1795, and it was called Letters for Literary Ladies, and it was made up of three different sets of letters.
This is Cliona O'Gallagher of University College Cork, an expert on Maria's feminism.
One was a letter between two gentlemen who were discussing whether or not girls should be educated. The second is between two women, letters of Julia and Caroline. And the third is, in fact, an essay. It's called An Essay on the Noble Art of Self-Justification.
So Letters for Literary Ladies begins with a dialogue between two gentlemen on the birth of a daughter to one of them. And it takes the form of a debate.
That's right. It was partly based on a real exchange of ideas between Edgeworth's father and his very good friend Thomas Day. And Thomas Day knowing that Edgeworth had different ideas about women's education. And I think it's really interesting that Edgeworth, you know, took up this dialogue between two men and turned it to her own purposes, made it into a way to argue for women's education.
It is not possible that women should ever be our equals in knowledge. We men mix with the world without restraint. We converse freely with all classes of people, with the artist, the mechanic, the labourer. Every scene of life is open to our view. Whenever women appear, even when we seem to admit them as our equals in understanding, everything assumes a different form. Our politeness, delicacy, habits towards the fair sex forbid us to argue or to converse with them as we do with one another. We see things as they are, but women must always see things through a veil or cease to be women.
He's a little bit like one of those bro science guys from Silicon Valley that says the reason there aren't many women in tech is because women aren't very good at this. And the second letter starts to fall in to try and answer those fundamentally misogynistic arguments.
I think one of the interesting things about the letters between Julia and Caroline is that they are an argument about whether women can be sensible, that is, whether they are rational beings or whether they're simply creatures of sensibility. And it's very likely that Jane Austen picks up on this text and is thinking of it when she later writes Sense and Sensibility.
In vain, dear Caroline, you urge me to think. I profess only to feel. Reflect upon my own feelings, analyse my notions of happiness, explain to you my system. But I have no system. That is the very difference between us. You, Caroline, are of a more sedate, contemplative character. Philosophy becomes the rigid mistress of your life, enchanting enthusiasm the companion of mine. What has woman to do with philosophy? A woman's part in life is to please. What can woman gain from reason? Can she prove by argument that she is amiable, or demonstrate that she is an angel?
I think what's also really interesting is that Edgeworth wrote that in 1787. And of course, you know, Austen's novel is much later, it would be 1811, I think. And Edgeworth is a really important writer to show us that there is a continuity in terms of women thinking on these quite intellectual questions.
I think one of the most interesting connections between Edgeworth and Austen has to do with a kind of familiar plot we know from Austen, which is the plot of First and Second Affections.
This is Professor James Chandler of the University of Chicago. He's talking about the book that Maria wrote after Letters for Literary Ladies. It explores many of the same themes and is probably her most influential novel, Belinda.
So in Sense and Sensibility, first novel to be published, we have Marianne, who falls for the young villain. I can never remember his name, as Willoughby or Wickham. And this turns out to be a terrible mistake. This is her first affection. Her second affection is with Colonel Brandon, much older man, much more stable. We see very much the same thing in Emma. And in Belinda, Edgeworth has a version of this same plot, where we're introduced to Clarence Harvey, who's a dashing figure of genius and wit and cuts a social figure. And he and Belinda take a fancy to each other. But then there's this other person who comes along, Mr. Vincent, and the language of first and second affections is already there in very explicitly. Oh, you mustn't trust your first affections. It's the second affections that matter. You think you're in a Jane Austen novel, except no, Mr. Vincent turns out to be a gambler and a terrible person. And the dashing Clarence Harvey, suspect throughout the novel, turns out to be the right lover for the pure Belinda. So what Edgeworth has done is to anticipate Jane Austen's structure of first and second affections, even before Jane Austen came along to do it.
Essentially, what Maria Edgeworth does in Belinda is to undermine all kinds of conventions. Her heroine dares to think for herself and to make her own decisions.
The central plot, as is the case with many novels of this period written by women, concerns a young woman who is effectively looking for a husband. And she meets with a very witty, aristocratic, very intelligent older woman called Lady Delacour, who becomes her sort of mentor in London. And she's also the niece of a fairly notorious matchmaking woman called Mrs. Stanhope. And it's really about her moral journey between many different characters, many different women and types of women, and how she both retains and develops a sense of moral autonomy in the middle of this very complex social world that she lives in.
Mrs. Stanhope, a well-bred woman, accomplished in that branch of knowledge which is called the art of rising in the world, had, with but a small fortune, contrived to live in the highest company. She prided herself upon having established half a dozen nieces most happily, that is to say, upon having married them to men of fortunes far superior to their own. One niece still remained unmarried, Belinda Portman, of whom she was determined to get rid with all convenient expedition. Belinda was handsome, graceful, sprightly, and highly accomplished. Her aunt had endeavored to teach her that a young lady's chief business is to please in society, that all her charms and accomplishments should be invariably subservient to one grand object, the establishing of herself in the world.
Her novels have a much wider social canvas than Jane Austen's novels. There's a much greater range of social class. There's also much greater geographical range. And that was why, even though she was a female novelist, she is said to have influenced Walter Scott and other writers who wanted to give this bigger, broader canvas to their fictions.
In Belinda, Maria takes apart male ideas about how women should be. The novel's romantic hero, Clarence, finally realises that he's got it all wrong about what he wants in a wife once he falls in love with the coolly intelligent, independent Belinda. But Clarence only finds this out after a failed experiment in which he takes an orphaned girl, Virginia, and tries to mould her into his ideal woman.
Thomas Day, her father's best friend, had actually done this in real life with two orphans because he was so appalled by what he considered to be the conventional feminine character, and he wanted to try and create an ideal woman. And she'd already had a go at Thomas Day in the letter to a gentleman on the birth of his daughter. And this was her second foray into the same territory. It's an immensely philosophical subplot, which has the most interesting ideas about human education in general, about, you know, what it is to live in the world. It's been compared, I think by you actually at one point, with Frankenstein, this idea of creating a perfect being.
Like Victor Frankenstein in Mary Shelley's novel, Clarence's misguided attempt to create his ideal woman nearly ends in disaster and the ruin of Virginia's chances of future happiness. The plot shows how critical Maria Edgeworth was of exclusive male claims to knowledge and power.
At the same time that she's in some ways critiquing a system that's very clearly very imperfect, she's also very realistic about the extent to which you can change things. So Edgeworth is not a revolutionary. She's definitely a reformer. She sees what the problems are and she advocates change. But she doesn't want anyone to become a victim, I suppose, of a very, very revolutionary upheaval. And that includes women who try, perhaps, to be too avant-garde in their ideas or their behaviour, which she thinks will ultimately lead to misery and potentially a kind of destruction for them.
This is making the novel sound very serious, but it's actually full of humour.
There's cross-dressing.
Yeah, there's lots of cross-dressing. There's the pigs that chase the duelling women. The women's duel, yes. Yeah. All kinds of bizarre incidents with which Edgeworth peppers the plot.
She was often called witty, and witty was a term that was sometimes regarded as dangerous or ambivalent in relation to women. And it meant not just being funny, it also meant having quite a sort of a cutting sense of comedy. And that was one of the things that Edgeworth excelled in. And we also find in Jane Austen as well, that slightly cutting sense.
Maria Edgeworth was brilliant at using humour to make serious points in her fiction. But she was also keenly aware of the power of literature to change people's minds and bring about political change. This awareness was heightened during a long visit she made to Bristol from 1791 to 93. She met a number of radical activists, including the doctor and chemist Thomas Beddoes. Beddoes later married Maria's sister Anna. This is how her father, Richard, described him.
He is a little fat Democrat of considerable abilities, of great name in the scientific world as a naturalist and chemist, good-humoured, good-natured, a man of honour and virtue, enthusiastic and sanguine. His manners are not polite, but he is sincere and candid.
Bristol in the 1790s attracted radicals like Beddoes, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, and Thomas Clarkson. The city's wealth came from the slave trade. But it was also an important centre for anti-slavery campaigners, and Maria was prompted to find out more. Here's what she wrote to her cousin Sophie in March 1792.
Have you seen any of the things that have been lately published about the Negroes? We have just read a very small pamphlet, an account of the facts stated to the House of Commons. I wish you could see it. Though indeed the cruelties are so extremely shocking that it cannot do the mind good to hear of them. Only so far as it tends to excite universal indignation against slave captains and the slave trade. 25,000 families in England have absolutely entirely left off eating West India sugar in anything, from the hope that when there is no longer any demand for sugar, the slaves will not be so cruelly treated.
The Royal Maritime Museum at Greenwich celebrates the achievements of seafarers, but it doesn't shy away from also documenting the horror of some of their actions of the past. It's where I've come to meet Sarah Lodge, a specialist in 19th century literature and culture, to hear more about what was happening at this time.
1792 is a really important year for the discussion of slavery in Britain. In some ways, it's at a peak of slaving. We know that 204 ships left Africa bound for the Americas, full of slaves. But at the same time in 1792, there were no fewer than 519 petitions presented to Parliament by people asking for the abolition of slavery.
In June, the newspapers reported on an horrific case.
Captain John Kimber, who was the captain of the slave ship Recovery, he was charged with murder for having flogged a 15-year-old slave girl who had refused to dance when he asked her to on deck. He hung her by her feet and flogged her, and she died as a result of her injuries. And although Kimber was acquitted in court, he was very much not acquitted in the court of British public opinion. And we can see satirical cartoons by Cruikshank, for example, of which there's a copy in the Maritime Museum, which show this poor girl being hung by the feet while the sailors themselves are saying, "We do not treat our girls at Wapping so." So I think what was so powerful for the British public was the idea that a 15-year-old black girl, a slave girl, was expressing ideas of virgin modesty that were congruent with ideas of how civilized people behave, whereas it was the white man in this instance who was behaving unnaturally, barbarously, and trading in human flesh, something that had a strong connotation of prostitution. So the idea that this was sexual abuse, as well as the abuse of general human rights, I think it struck a powerful chord with people like Maria Edgeworth, who were concerned with women's rights, as well as the rights of people of colour.
Further up the Thames, in the London docks, just a mile or so away from where we're standing, Maria did a remarkable thing.
We went on board a slave ship with my brother and saw the dreadfully small hold in which the poor slaves are stowed together so that they cannot stir. Some of the slaves are sent every morning to scour the decks with brine, and the ship, we were told, was daily fumigated with vinegar.
I find myself thinking of what she would actually have experienced, the sights, the smells. I think it would have been extremely rank. judging from what we know of slave ships, there would probably have been at least 350 slaves and probably more in the hold of the ship. In really horrible conditions, they would probably have been lying flat on their back or kneeling. Many of the slaves suffered from dysentery, or what was known as flux, and we have an account of a ship's surgeon who treated them, where of those 359 slaves that he was with, at least 16 of them died on their way to the Americas. So there was a stench of disease. And it is an extraordinary thing when one comes to think about it, that a woman and a novelist should go on board a slave ship. It's pretty unheard of. And I think it shows the extraordinary gumption of Maria Edgeworth and her real commitment to the investigative journalism involved in finding something like that out for herself with her own eyes.
Maria doesn't really express her feelings about what she'd seen in her letter to her cousin Sophie. But the indignation that she felt about slavery comes through in stories she wrote on the subject afterwards. One of these stories, aimed at teenage readers, is The Good Aunt. It centres on a young boy, Charles Howard, brought up by an aunt who encourages him to think for himself and to be truthful and just. At school, Charles Howard gets into a fight with an older boy, Augustus, who believes that he has the right to dominate and bully other younger boys. His victims include a West Indian boy called Oliver, who's flogged and abused every day, until Howard stands up to defend him against Augustus's assumption that Oliver is naturally inferior and deserves this harsh treatment. He fights Augustus and wins.
"Be my friend," said Howard, taking Oliver in his arms. The word "friend" went to the little Creole's heart, and he clung to Howard in silence. Regularly, every evening, Oliver brought his books to his friend. Oliver was delighted to find that he understood Howard's explanations. His opinion of himself rose with the opinion that he saw his instructor had of his abilities. He was convinced that he was not doomed to be a dunce for life. His ambition was rekindled. His industry was encouraged by hope and rewarded by success. His heart was light, his spirits rose. To his masters and his companions, he appeared a new creature.
I think Maria Edgeworth has been misunderstood as a much more conservative writer than she actually is, partly because much of what she says is implied rather than stated. It's part of her rational, educative program to let people make their own minds up. But she gives us the ingredients from which we can construct our own connections. And particularly strong connections, I think, between children and how children can be tyrannized over, both by adults and other children, women, and how women can be subject to tyrannical rule. Tenants, peasants, slaves, people who are disempowered in other ways.
Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long ways from home. A long ways from home.
As a motherless child herself, Maria Edgeworth felt strongly about those who'd suffered under neglect or unjust government. Her novel Ennui, for instance, published in 1809, is all about who's fit to rule and whether characters and talents are innate or learnt. Here's Professor Claire Connolly of University College Cork.
Well, it's a remarkable novel because she takes the idea, which she takes from fairy tales and very old European stories, of somebody being swapped in the cradle or changed at nurse. So a young man grows up thinking he is the Anglo-Irish aristocrat, the heir to the estate. He learns painfully during the course of the novel that he's actually the son of a peasant woman, the woman who was his nurse. So it's an amazing way of just absolutely turning upside down questions of identity and inheritance. Are you who you were born, or are you who you were educated to be?
Lord Glenthorne, you hear the truth. You hear that I am your lawful mother. Yes, you are my son. You have forced that secret from me. Poor good Christie. He that I've wronged and robbed of his rightful inheritance has been as a son, a dutiful good son to me. He who is slaving now at the forge to give me the earnings of his labour. He that lives and has lived all his days upon potatoes and salt and is content. He who has the face and the hands so disguised with the smoke and the black that you yourself asked him t'other day, did he ever wash his face since he was born? I tell you, he it is who should live in this castle and sleep on that soft bed and be lord of all here. He is the true and the real Lord Glenthorne, and to the wide world I'll make it known. I be pale and tremble, do. In the face of day, I shall confess the wrong I've done, and I shall call upon you to give back to him all that by right is his own.
And of course, the real heir turns out not to want the job. He feels he's not fitted for it, he hasn't had the education for it. Though by birth it is his, it isn't the identity that he wants to assume. What does that tell us about Edgeworth's understanding of Irish identity at the time that she was writing?
That identity is a matter of education and not birth. That identity comes with responsibilities and requires reading and thinking. And also that these questions of identity belong in the realm of kind of experiment as well. She's trying something out with this novel. She's seeing how far you can take the nature-nurture debate, if you like, in Irish political contexts. And I suppose in the end it shows you that in a novel like Ennui, in a way Edgeworth is willing to kind of burn down the house, because that's what happens in Ennui. The big house is burned to the ground and everyone has to start again.
The novel explores the ways the English misunderstand the Irish.
One of my favourite scenes in Ennui is when the Earl of Glenthorne, recently arrived from England, sees turf cutting on the bog on a very hot July day. And he notices that the workmen have fires lighting. And he marvels at the ignorance of these Irish peasants who are lighting fires on this very hot summer's day. But as the description goes on, you're given to understand that the reasons they're lighting fires is to keep the midges away. And I think it's a kind of a warning to different kinds of readers. It's saying, if you are an English reader and this is your first time encountering life in the Irish Midlands, don't just take one look. Look again, read more closely, and understand the value and the dignity of the cultural practices of these people living marginal lives in pre-famine Ireland.
The ways in which Mariah Edgeworth portrayed the Irish in her works show her complex relationship with her own Anglo-Irish identity.
The Edgeworths came into their land in County Longford in the aftermath of the Cromwellian plantation, following the dispossession, of course, of the native Irish. And I think the Ireland that she grew up in and around the borders of Longford and Westmeath, you could think of it almost as the kind of frontier of Anglo-Ireland at the end of the 18th and the start of the 19th century. And there in that really distinctive landscape of lakes and bogland, the Edgeworths, along with other ascendancy families, settled and made their home. And it's on that kind of uncertain terrain, if you like, that boggy landscape, that identity is to be found, which is a way of saying it's never going to be simple or straightforward, but it is deeply immersed in that distinctive place and landscape, I think.
So should we call her an Anglo-Irish writer, an ascendancy writer, an Irish writer?
we should call her an Irish writer. We should call her our most first and most important Irish woman writer, I think. But that is an Irishness that grew out of this threshold frontier boggy place with its distinctive problems of identity. But nonetheless, from all of that material, she really forged such a kind of distinctive way of writing and talking and thinking about Ireland.
Mariah Edgeworth's novels represented Irish lives and Irish voices for an international readership in a completely new way. So why has she been largely forgotten? Why isn't she as well known as Jane Austen or the Brontes? James Chandler believes that her Anglo-Irish identity is partly to blame.
She's a writer who, I think, is not read so much in Ireland because she's Protestant, not read so much in England because she's Irish, and that's a tough place for her to have been.
Camilla Kelly of the Edgeworth Society thinks there was also another element at play.
The position of female writers in Ireland was invisible for so long.
But times have changed. 2018 marked an upsurge of interest in Mariah Edgeworth. It was the 250th anniversary of her birth, and events throughout the year brought her to global attention, with commemorative events held in Rome, York and Dublin. Claire Connolly gave a talk at the Royal Irish Academy at an event that brought together some of today's leading Irish women writers.
Tonight I'm just going to briefly sketch out the terrain of Edgeworth's life in literature and in criticism.
An exhibition of letters written by Mariah attracted crowds to the National Library, who were thrilled to see the letters close up for the first time.
And you really get a sense, I guess, of her personality from the letter, mm-hmm. in that, you know, the handwriting's clear and there's kind of an immediacy, I suppose, about it. I think it's wonderful.
And a conference in Trinity College Dublin brought together scholars from all over the world.
My name's Deborah Weiss. I am an associate professor of English at the University of Alabama in the United States, where I regularly teach Mariah Edgeworth in my classes.
My name is Aino Hataya. I come from Turku in Finland, and I'm working there at Åbo Akademi University, where I'm doing a PhD on Mariah Edgeworth.
My name is Rieko Suzuki. I'm from Japan. I'm interested in Mariah Edgeworth because I believe she is one of the pioneers of historical narrative.
Back in Edgeworth's town in County Longford, the Edgeworth Society also had a busy year in 2018. They produced a special supplement for the Irish Independent newspaper. They put on a literary festival centering on Mariah's work. And they ran tours of Edgeworth's town that drew visitors from all over the globe. A highlight of the year was a performance of Mariah's novel Castle Rackrent, adapted for the stage.
I almost think it's Mariah expressing how she feels in her alter ego, because this is a play that really takes on her own class at the time in a very comedic, dramatic, tragic way. And then the local group from Edgeworthstown who participated and acted in the play were absolutely wonderful.
It was the first time I ever got involved with the writings of Mariah Edgeworth.
Local man Peter Costello grew up hearing the name of Mariah Edgeworth and was aware of her legacy. But it was only when he was asked to take part in the stage version of Castle Rackrent that he found out what her writing was like, how funny and subversive it is.
They asked me to come in and be part of an assembly for backing singing and be a peasant in it. I was reluctant at first, but then I decided that I would go in. So I went in on a Sunday. It was about 3 weeks before the show. And I was put into a room, and John Power was the musical director from London. He was over this, and he asked me to sing a song. So I sang a song during it reluctantly and then sang another one. And he put me through pitches with my voice, and he thought my voice was quite good that I could pitch some of the notes. So he asked me then, he says, are you in? And I says, yeah, sure, hung for sheep as lamb, I'll take it on. So I ended up doing two solo songs in the show.
So what were the songs? What were they about?
Well, the first one was a ballad. It was called The Ballad of Sir Kit. It was about when he died during the show. We had to sing a song over his dead body, over his body while he was laying on the
stage.
So
he's one of the owners of the castle at one point in
Correct.
The story, isn't he?
Correct. And then the last song was The Wake. One of the main characters in the show wanted to see what it'd be like to have his own funeral.
So he stages his own death?
So he stages his own death and we do this, the wake over his supposed body, and then he come alive during the third verse of the song in which he sang the third verse. And it was very funny. It was good. Muller, muller, dearna qualcha. Erlang usul is grisha, freedom, freedom. Eroga, I guess, egg, titum, egg, titum. Ari, a toimla, is chock so canog. Oh, here's to Sir Conde, Sir Connolly Conde. He was born of a Tuesday and died on a Monday. Was there ever a one so easy and free? Says I to myself, and myself says to me, la da 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 da, la da 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 da, la da dee.
Now, Susan, we'll head across to St. John's Church and Graveyard.
And this is where Mariah Edgeworth is buried.
It is, yeah. This is where she's buried in the vault here beside us.
So we can see that there's a kind of raised tomb within these iron railings. Who was buried here exactly, Matt?
Well, there are a number of members of the family. Richard, Mariah's grandfather, Richard Lovell, Mariah. Mariah's brother William is buried here. And again, unusually, there are members of the family. Are they household staff buried here? Here's a plaque on the wall to Kitty, who is mentioned very often in Mariah's letters.
She was the housekeeper, wasn't she?
She was the housekeeper, and she's also interred with the family here in the vault here in Edgeworthstown. Very unusual.
So we're just inside the church itself. It's quite a simple building. And right inside the door, we have a case with a few objects. Now, it looks like a clay pipe. There's a little lace-knitted glove.
This belonged to Mariah. And here we have a little purse with ME written on it. We know that she was fond of sewing and embroidering, so we assume that she probably put that on it herself. If we go up further in the church here, we can see some memorial plaques to members of the family, including Richard Edgeworth, Richard Lovell, and the great lady herself, Mariah.
Mariah Edgeworth, born 1st of January 1767, died 22nd of May 1849. Actually, scholars now think that was January 1768, but at the time that was thought to be the right date. And it looks very like the plaque just above it, which is a memorial plaque for her father, Richard Lovell Edgeworth. And again, it just has his birth and death dates. Very, very simple memorials.
In the rectory, we have the letter dictated to Mariah by her father the year before he died. And it's his burial wish. And in that, he expressly insisted that only a small plaque, a simple plaque, similar to that one that we're looking here at on the left-hand side for his father, be erected for him. And I assume that Mariah probably left the same instructions that a simple plaque similar to that of her father and her grandfather be erected for her. And
yes,
here it is.
I think that's right.
In the church.
She didn't want anything extravagant. They didn't want to make a great show to display their importance or anything like that. They wanted to kind of maintain the sense that they were quite simple, straightforward people. So do we know where the family sat in the church?
Yeah, if you just look here at the front on the right-hand side as we look down the church, there's an enclosed pew, and that was the family pew.
Could we go and sit there?
Of course you can, yes, of course you can.
Yes, it's interesting to feel that I could be sitting in the very spot that Mariah sat in every Sunday.
Feels quite charged.
Maria Edgeworth died on the 22nd of May, 1849, at the age of 81. But her work continues to resonate.
Maria Edgeworth stands at the head of a really important line of women writers, right up to Anne Enright, women who ask us to think about what it means to be both Irish and a woman, and who give us language and imagery and plots for thinking through the dilemmas of Irish identity and the role of women in Irish society.
She's a writer of extraordinary intellect. She's arguably the most important writer of English fiction between, say, Laurence Sterne and Jane Austen and Walter Scott, writing anywhere in the English-speaking world.
The fact that she's a woman writing at this particular moment, and that she is actually a very successful professional writer, she's really a trailblazer there.
A friend once advised Maria Edgeworth to write on, shine out. And I believe she did shine out. She's a star as bright as Jane Austen, and she deserves to be just as celebrated.
Radical Life was presented by Susan Manley, who is currently writing a new biography of Maria Edgeworth. The extracts from Maria Edgeworth's writings were read by Deira Nivrian, and letters by her father, Richard Lovell Edgeworth, were read by Andrew Bennett. The programme was produced by Claire Cunningham with sound supervision by Tin Pot Productions. The lyric feature is available as a podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and also from the RTE Radio Player and the Lyric FM website. You can contact the Lyric feature by email, features.lyricfm@rte.ie.